Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. And believe me, this is going to be stretching your mental space, perhaps in ways that you never, ever expected. Are you a Star Trek fan? Do you like anything that has to do with exploring the universe? What about parallel universes? Multi-universal theories? What do you think? Well, personally, I think it's very real stuff. However, we're going to be finding out more about this topic with my guest today, Dr. Stephen Manley. His book is called Visions of the Multi-Universe. Dr. Manley, welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna. Thanks for having me on.
Do you mind if I call you Stephen?
No, you can call me Steve. I wasn't quite sure. I mean, they didn't ask me about the whole doctor thing on front on the book. I wasn't very happy when I saw that. I was like, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that goes around with my doctor in front of me. I'm sort of the other side.
I gotcha.
I tend to make fun of the MDs walking around the hospital with their little name tags that always say MD. So having done that all my life, when I first saw the cover of the book and saw the doctor, I was like, oh, that's horrible.
Okay.
But I figured they knew more about selling books than I did, so I wasn't going to say much.
Okay. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Manley. Don't go away.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
We're back. For those of you that are just now tuning in, Dr. Steve Manley is with me, and we were joking about how he doesn't like to be called doctor, and I get to call him Steve, which I think is wonderful. Visions of the multi-universe. Do parallel universes really exist? And Steve, you say the term multiple universe is a bit of an oxymoron. How so?
Well, I mean, universe is a pretty powerful word. What is in a universe? It's everything you can think of ever experiencing. Well, anything you can experience. And that's the starting place. If you're going to consider a multiple universe, you have to decide what is a universe. And so to me, it is everything that we could ever possibly experience. And what I mean by that is what you can see, feel, touch, what you could develop some sort of a detector to actually see. So you could consider things like instrumentation. So I throw in this, you know, things like quarks and subatomic particles, where me and my buddies build big detectors, and we can actually infer their existence. So that type of thing I consider part of our universe.
Mm-hmm.
But then you might ask, are there realms outside of that? And that, surprisingly, the answer is yes. I think there might be, and that's where the whole idea of the multiverse comes in.
When we look at history, and you bring this point out right in the very beginning of the book, you start off with Copernicus. When we look at the beginning of science as in our modern world is understood, it really is still in its sort of baby stage. It's
wow.
Like a toddler, how I would describe it. is that the toddler has suddenly decided that they can...
You can hear me. I'm getting a big horn in my ear, so I'm hanging up.
Okay, well, apparently we are having a problem. They're hearing something. He's hearing something on the phone line, so Don will have to call him back. Okay, Don is going to call him, and then Don can just let me know by beeping me when he's back on the line. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Manley. Now, just to give you a little bit of information on him, he works on experiments at high-energy accelerators around the world. Now, he really enjoys investigating the structure of matter and the various forces of nature that we encounter on a daily basis. He's written over 200 scientific publications, and he has a PhD in high-energy physics from Columbia University. He teaches currently at the University of Rochester, and he says he terrorizes his students, which that would be interesting to see. And in 2003, he was named the New York State Professor of the Year, and more recently was the recipient of the 2007 Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching Award by the American Association of Physics Teachers. Hi, Steve, you're back with us.
Yeah, sorry about that, Donna. On my end, it sounded like somebody blew a foghorn in my ear, and it just kept going, so I finally had to hang up. So sorry to leave you there.
No, that's all right. Don't worry. We just filled in with information about your unique and very illustrious background. Now, let's go back to talking about the history, because it's really in the last 150 years, in your evaluation, that we've really made some strides with science. And when you look at history and you look at how religious organizations said, no, we can't have this, that, or the other, and whatever the belief systems were that were in place throughout the centuries, it really put an axe right in the middle of development. What do you think was the catalyst for us to suddenly start coming out of our sleeping intellectual stupor to be able to move forward in this last 150 years?
Wow. You know, I think there's a lot of inertia there in the system that has nothing necessarily to do with religion. I think it's just human nature to like what seems familiar and comfortable to us. And to me, what has really launched the exciting scientific revolutions, the revolution that's come about in the last 150 years, I think a big part of it really is scientific methodology, which is you have to go with what you observe in nature, even if it seems a little bit strange relative to what you might have expected. And I guess the other thing I would add to that is just the sheer audacity of the human imagination. I mean, people actually do come up with these big revolutionary ideas, and that's a starting place. And then you have to formulate how is it you can look for evidence of these things existing or not. And that's where the power of scientific methodology comes in, because in the end, observation wins. So there are just all sorts of examples. I mean, one is, of course, Copernicus, where the Earth-centered universe was what people were accepting, and then we came out with the idea of the heliocentric universe or the sun-centered universe, and in fact, that fit the data better. When Galileo looked out with his telescope, he saw phases of Venus that could be accounted for in a sun-centered universe, but not an Earth-centered universe, and the data, you know, slowly was found to fit the new plan. Einstein totally revolutionized our ideas of space and time through something totally unexpected. I mean, if you assume that the speed of light is the same no matter what your point of view, so this is very different from I guess the story I tell is if you're a bored teenager and I'm sure none of your listeners would have ever done this, but I grew up in sort of backwoods redneck North Carolina. So when you get bored, one of the things you could do is go for a ride and throw bottles at mailboxes and bash them. Not that I ever did this, but I did have friends who did. And so if you were just standing there and tossed a bottle at a mailbox, you really couldn't cause much damage to it. But if you're in a car that's going very fast and you toss the bottle out the window, it'll cause a lot of damage to the mailbox. And the reason is, when you launch the bottle from a moving platform, the bottle's moving faster. And so this is Newtonian physics, and we're all used to this. This is what we grow up believing. It turns out that if instead of throwing a bottle, you're actually shooting a ray of light, it doesn't matter how fast you're going, you will always measure that light going the same speed. And that is completely counterintuitive from anything that we grow up with and works in our normal world. But that turns out to be something that's an experimental fact. Einstein incorporated this in his thinking in relativity, and when he did, he found that space and time are not absolute the way we all grow up thinking that they are. Absolute revolution. And it took, you know, the genius of Einstein to make that step, but then people went out and actually made measurements and found that, in fact, as weird as this is, it's really true. And so that's where science really comes in, because even if it bothers you, if it's what you see out there, then that's what you have to incorporate in your thinking.
I think we are going to find so many various components that are going to become observable and actually manufacturable in their own unique particular environments that the students of science today are just going to say, well, of course, that's the way it was supposed to be. After all, they showed it on Star Trek 35 years ago. Of course, this
I
is
sure
where it's
so.
Supposed to be. I mean, I really fully expect to hear that sometime in the future. You had a story in your book when you were a graduate student in physics at Columbia University in New York City, and I just loved it. It was a rolled-up rug story. And
oh,
I
goodness.
Love how you said, I had a lot of stuff that went on in my life that makes for great cocktail conversation. You
yeah.
never run out of material, so tell us about this story, because it really is something.
Oh, well, that was a funny story. So, I mean, first of all, to give you a little bit of perspective, I grew up in a small town in North Carolina, and I gladly call it Redneck North Carolina. I mean, there were nice people and everything, but it really was. I grew up 15 miles from the nearest McDonald's, I grew up on a small college campus where my dad was a professor, and I went to school there, to college, and so here I was, 22, getting ready to start graduate school, and I thought it was time for a change. And so I moved to Manhattan, and boy, talk about a change. When I started graduate school, there were students in my class from all over the world, from Beijing and Athens and Paris, and they were vastly more comfortable in New York City than I was, because they were used to big cities. So it was quite a change. At any rate, I'd been at Columbia for a couple of years, and I was sitting in my apartment one evening, and there's this loud knocking at the door, and I answered it, and there was a made-for-television policeman there flashing his credentials right in my face. And, of course, this was I was both horrified and absolutely thrilled at the same time, right? I hadn't had any interactions with the New York's finest at that point. So then he just said, I just have a couple of questions to ask you. And he said, he asked me if I had noticed a rug outside my apartment building within the last couple of days, a red rug. And to tell you, you know, I said, well, no, not really. And the reason was because we were there by a number of, well, I guess we call them fraternity brownstones. Basically, instead of fraternity houses there at Columbia, they have these little brownstones. And so we were on the street where most of those brownstones were. And sometimes the students would throw out lots of furniture, old furniture and stuff, and rugs. And so it wasn't unusual to have rugs and furniture on the corner by my apartment building. And after a while, you just stopped seeing it. So I hadn't noticed it. And, of course, I just said, well, what's this all about? Because, of course, I was perversely fascinated. I wonder why a cop was asking me this stuff. And he says, I'm sorry, I'm not at liberty to say. Well, the next morning, I picked up the Columbia School newspaper, and the story was there. So as the story went, seven freshman boys, and it was about 2 weeks into the start of their freshman first year, so it was in September, they had gone out downtown, obviously doing what seven freshman boys are prone to do at that age. They'd go out, they were out drinking, and when they came back late at night, they saw this rug sitting out in front of the building. They figured, well, now that's a cool rug. We should just go, we're setting up our suite. So they dragged the rug, they carried the rug up to their room, and they unrolled it, and in the middle of that rug was a dead body with two bullet holes in the head.
Woo-hoo!
And it is not, you know, it's really not funny. But I always because I keep thinking about the phone call that these boys would have to give to their parents, right? They've been in school for 2 weeks. And then the other thing that makes me laugh is, you know, that they were going up the stairs. Every one of them thought the other guys weren't carrying their weight because it was so heavy, I'm sure. At any rate, so Columbia is a great school, and I think that not everybody has that kind of experience, so I don't want to leave anybody with the wrong impression.
As you can tell, you're going to have some unique material to read when you get his book on the multi-universes. Let's talk about a couple of things. You make a statement, time is the fabric in which we determine when things are with respect to one another. You bring up a terminology called additive speeds. Explain those.
Well, that was that's a little bit like the bottle analogy I was talking about a moment ago. If let me try a different analogy because maybe it'd make more sense. If you are walking along, say a couple of miles per hour, and then you step on a moving sidewalk, say at the airport, that's moving at a couple of miles per hour, then someone who is off to the side will actually see you moving at 4 miles per hour. Because if you don't break stride, you basically add the speed of your walk to the speed of the moving sidewalk. And this becomes really important because it turns out that light doesn't really work that way. That even if I am going very fast and I shine a flashlight, I will measure light to travel at the same speed. And people in other reference frames, or people off to the side as I go traveling by very fast, would measure the light at the same speed. And so these two are really intellectually contradictory. And it's a place where it's just a fact that the speed of light is the same to people in different reference frames. And this is the thing that makes relativity actually go. So it's a very exciting and surprising sort of thing. And people had a hard time accepting it, I guess. So it's one of the places where our bias about nature, in a sense, as you said earlier, held us back for a while until Einstein actually followed through and said, well, you know, the experiments say this, and if we assume this, then here's what happens. And what he found was that time is relative. The flow of time is different for people in different reference frames. So the passage of an hour for us will be different for somebody who is zipping by in a fast spaceship, for example. So this is, this isn't science fiction, and this isn't even really multiple universe stuff. This is actually physics that's been known very well for 105 years now.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting. And one of the things I will tell people when I'm talking about the subject sometimes is you don't actually have to get into the multiple universe side of this to find out just how weird our universe is. I mean, there's a lot of really cool stuff out there.
Oh, absolutely, and we're far from knowing at all about it. You make a comment in your book about gravity and how it warps the fabric of space-time and affects the passage of time. Clocks, you say, at the surface of the Earth will run at a slightly different rate from clocks on satellites in orbit. That is, when you start wrapping your mind around that, you go, well, gee whiz, what do we all need? An atomic clock when they're out of space and then when we're down on the planet itself. How much time difference is there between the clocks on, let's say, the satellites in outer space or any of the space shuttles that have been out of space, in outer space? how did they coordinate the computer activity down here on Earth with what's going on in outer space if there's a time differential, and if so, how much?
Well, I can't right off the top of my head tell you the number, but it's quite Googleable and is very calculable. I mean, people know very well. NASA engineers and aerospace engineers, I mean, and physicists can calculate these numbers exactly, because these are measurable differences, and it's essential, for example, to know that the global positioning system, for example, where we put a bunch of satellites up in the sky, and you can basically determine your position on Earth to, something like a meter. It works by looking at the signals from different satellites and looking at the relative timing. You cannot get that accuracy unless you make corrections for this effect. And what we're talking about is general relativity. So this was a theory that Einstein put out in 1916, 1917. And it's a fascinating theory. In special relativity, what you do is you relate observations from one person to another where they move at a constant speed with respect to one another. So that that constraint of constant is what you mean when you say special in special relativity. And it turns out that when you make transformations from one person to another, you get weird things like time passes at different rates and measurements of length are different. So you have things like a football field. If you went zipping by a football field going at 98% the speed of light, it would actually look like it's 20 yards long to you if you were measuring it and you were in the spaceship. And as strange as that seems, it's actually, this is real stuff. Now, that's in special relativity, and it turns out that when you do a transformation of something that you measure, like if two events are simultaneous in one reference frame and you transform that into how are they observed in the other reference frame, you find that the transformation from one reference frame to another not only depends on when the events happen, but where they happen. So mathematically, you mix up space and time. So people post special relativity don't really talk about space and time as separate things. They're actually sort of get mixed together, called space-time. And so then the next big step happened over the next 10 years. Einstein realized that there was a deep fundamental relationship between acceleration and gravity, which, again, I mean, Einstein made a lot of great advances sort of seeing the obvious in some ways. If you've been in an elevator and you press the button to go up and the elevator starts to accelerate upward, you feel heavier. I mean, you just do. And so Einstein basically said, well, you could imagine being in a room on Earth and you feel like you're pulled toward the floor, you feel the force of the floor on your feet. But you could imagine also having that same room out in space, way far away from any large body like the Earth, and be in a rocket ship that's accelerating at the same acceleration that a rock would fall out of your hand going down to the Earth. So we would say accelerating at 1G, if you're familiar with that sort of terminology. And you couldn't tell the difference between those two cases. So he called this the equivalence principle, and it has some pretty interesting implications. So if you could imagine, and this would be easier to do if we were in the same room with a whiteboard, but let me see if I can pull this off. If you can imagine being in a rocket ship that is accelerating, so you're standing basically on the floor of the rocket ship, and it is zooming and going faster and faster, and you're basically, your head is going up in the direction the rocket ship is going, so the floor is down toward where the rocket engine is, and you're being pressed toward the floor, it's accelerating upward. If you now take a beam of light or a pulse of light and shoot it directly over, straight toward the wall off to the side, the beam of light travels at a finite speed, so as it's moving toward the wall, the floor of the rocket ship is moving upward because this rocket is accelerating, and so the beam of light is going at right angles to this acceleration. And so if you if you could picture this, what you would see if you try to picture the path the light takes through the room as it goes to the wall, if you were standing, say, outside the rocket ship, or inside the rocket ship, what you would see is this light would have a curved path, and it would hit the wall sort of toward the floor relative to where you shot it, because basically the rocket ship is accelerating up around it as it moves over toward the wall. I hope that that picture wasn't painted too quickly. But what this means is that the implication is, in the accelerated reference frame, the light travels in a curved path. And if Einstein then says that accelerated reference frames and gravitation are the same thing, that they cannot be, you can't tell the difference, then the implication is that light travels in a curved path near an object with a large gravitational field. And, of course, light travels in a straight line, so he then interpreted that as saying that means light is traveling along what is a straight line near a gravitating body, but that must mean that the gravitation bends space. So that's quite a stretch. But it turns out his whole theory of general relativity is built on a geometry of curved space. And the whole idea is that massive objects and energy can basically distort space. And since space and time are all mixed together, it also distorts time. So again, this may sound like science fiction, but this is actually not. And this is our premier theory of gravitation these days. And people have done many, many experiments to, and general relativity is very well supported. And as I say, it even has practical uses. You have to take into account effects of this nature to make the global positioning system work. It's really very exciting stuff.
Well, it's something that for young people that are getting into science, when they can see the practical applications and be able to see that their imaginations don't have to be inside of a box, that there is a lot more out there, it's really quite exciting. Now, you talk about quantum fluctuations in an inflating space-time matrix. Now, this sounds like something out of a science fiction movie. You talk about bubble universes, and you talk about quantum fluctuations in each bubble universe, and there's the multi-universe, and to me, it just is so reminiscent of what people have done to reach the level of technological sophistication that in our era is almost mind-boggling to the average person, because we are moving forward with our technology at such a rate that we are experiencing paradigm shifts in our thinking, in our use and applications of this technology, and we're making changes at this time that literally took a thousand years maybe to make for just one or two steps of what we've accomplished. And now we're not just doing one or two steps, we're moving forward at a rate that is not diminishing in speed, it is picking up in speed. So when you're talking about quantum fluctuations, when you're talking about these bubble universes, we're discovering, because of this technology, all of these different layers within layers within layers within layers. How has this transformed your thinking and your professional perspective as a scientist?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me make sure of one thing, though. I don't want to leave people thinking that we are able to observe other universes. We can infer their existence from some of the scientific theories that we have. So they make sense that they would be there, but by construction, we can't actually step outside of our universe and, you know, look back and see the multiple universes. For me, as a scientist, these things are very exciting and interesting, and I like to pursue what I can learn out of them, but in a sense, I'm pretty comfortable not knowing everything. I mean, I think to be a good researcher, you sort of have to be, I mean, you may want to know everything, and that helps drive you, but you have to be comfortable with the fact every day that you're not going to know everything, that everything isn't solved. So the speed with which things are happening is amazing. I mean, it's really hard to keep up, even within an area, you know, a narrow area of research, with all that's going on, not to mention everything else that's going on. I mean, if you start asking me about molecular biology, I mean, I know nothing, right? And I'm a scientist. You'd think I should know something about it, but I really don't know much about it. I know nothing about cutting-edge molecular biology. And within physics, there are areas of physics that I just really don't know much about. I mean, so in that sense, it's a little bit scary and sad, and it may be a little bit self-limiting, because sometimes the great advances come from breadth of knowledge and being able to take pieces from one thing and relate it to another. And that is getting harder and harder to have that kind of deep knowledge in the very particular areas, I think.
I would agree. One of the points you bring out in the latter part of your book is that in working with students, you find that teaching the thinking process and the analytical process is very difficult because students are relying so much on computers. But computers are only as accurate with their information as the data that's put in by the human beings that design them. And you say that computers can't be trusted to think and that students have to design test cases and check against known facts in order to build confidence in the calculations. Gee, we could say that about politicians. I mean, there's so much information out there, and there is a sense of complacency because of what we have gotten in, again, this technology. As a scientist, there is always that challenge. What would you say to a student that is coming up into the thought process of, gee, I want to be involved in science, I want to know about this, I want to be able to do things? What would you say to anyone that wanted to be a student of life, to be perfectly frank? It wouldn't just make any difference whether it was science, whether it was medicine, or what have you, so that they don't get stuck in these paradigms that sometimes are convoluted. They just are not what they appear to be. What would you say to someone today?
I think it's easy for us all of us, to be lazy when we think we can get away with it. And I think that when you get stuck in a paradigm, part of it is laziness because you're comfortable with it. And to try to fit something, it's easier to try to fit something new in your paradigm than to mess around with the paradigm, in a sense. And maybe there's a little bit of that in these students who are coming through. Computers are incredibly useful tools, and of course, in physics we use enormous amount, and we use lots of computer modeling in order to understand what we're looking at and how to design our experiments, and it's extremely useful. But you have to think about what you're seeing and what you're doing. So whenever you confront something new, you have to think about how to fit it into your paradigm. And I think that was, for example, one of Einstein's greatest strengths was his ability to sort of take the obvious and pursue it in a way that other people just didn't, because they were too used to thinking about it the way they usually were. And I think it does take a special person to be able to do that well.
I agree. And I think to learn how to think, to observe, to be able to articulate well, all that is a process that we have to learn. I don't think anybody comes in with a whole package. They had a little bit of pablum and they got it. I don't think so.
I agree. When I teach physics class here, the physics is one thing and I'm trying to teach them that, but to me what's more important is to try to teach students how to think their way through a problem that they've never confronted before. And if I can help them be comfortable in jumping into a problem that they've never confronted before and to try different things, then I feel like they've actually gotten something really useful out of the class, regardless of whether they learn physics or not.
Right, because then they'll be able to take and apply that to any modality they come in contact with. Dr. Stephen Manley, he likes to be called Steve, prefers to have the doctor left off the front. He is a man that has a love of science, presents in his book visions of the multi-universe, parallel realities. Do they exist? How many universes are there? What do we need to know? He has so many fascinating stories, including one about Olivia Newton-John. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. You're going to have to get the book to find out what it is. It is wonderful. Visions of the Multi-Universe. Dr. Manley, thank you so much for being with me today. It has been a delight, and I wish you nothing but the best and continue to do your teaching, because I think a lot of students are going to benefit from that.
Thank you, Donna. I really appreciate you having me on.
It's been a pleasure.
Great fun.
Thank you. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break for just a moment. Don't go anywhere, because we're going to be right back. Oh, and be sure to have a pad of paper and pen handy. This is Donna Sebo. Steve Manley, Dr. Steve Manley, was my guest. The Visions of a Multi-Universe. Check it out. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, here is our worldwide toll-free number of 888-815-9756. Again, the toll-free number is 888-815-9756. If you are a new listener to this broadcast, well, all you need to do is call in, give me your first name or initial, and I love to know what part of the country you're calling in from, and then I will tell you my mental impressions, and then you can ask me about anything that you like. I really find that it's so much fun when I have an opportunity to demonstrate. Of course, I've been doing this mind work for years, and I was in an environment where there were some professional people, and they said, gee whiz, what do you see? There was a particular environment. And I started spitting out information, and their eyes got as big as saucers, and they went, whoa, what's going on? What people don't understand is that there is, just like we were talking about with my guest, Steve Manley, today, that there's no such thing as time or space. And when it comes to the factor of the mind and the intuitive process, there is information that you can literally read. The mind, your senses will pick up this information. It takes discipline and work to be able to use it, as I do, but it's something anybody can develop if you are of a mind to do so. And I find it so fascinating myself. I've never ceased to be amazed with this. So let's show you how it's done. We've got our first caller for the day on the line. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Oh, it's L. Leslie, and I'm calling from L.A.
Oh, welcome, Leslie. Is the sun shining down in Los Angeles?
I guess so, yes. I mean, it was 60-something, but it wasn't cold.
Well, the sun's shining. That's important. You need to hop and hop to send a little bit of it up here in the Pacific Northwest. We really would like some sun to shine through our gray skies of Seattle. Yes, absolutely.
Well, I'm sorry. I will share some with you.
Okay, good. I'll take all that I can get. All right, let's get down to business with you, Leslie. The first thing that is coming into my mind is organization, paying attention to detail, follow through, and don't allow distractions to throw you off of your focus, your concentration, and your deliberate plans of action. It's so important for you to hold true to what you need to do for yourself. Now, you have really been stripping away those factors of what you consider bad habits, unnecessary associations. You've been doing this on various levels for going on 3 years. You have really been alert and paying attention to your life. And I'm seeing you sort of sighing to yourself and saying, oh, good grief, does this ever stop? Am I ever going to get there? Oh, my Lord, it just seems if it's not one thing, it's something else. Yes, there's always going to be a process, dear. I love what Richard Bach said about within his book Illusions, and that is, if you're still here, your work isn't done. When you're finished, it's bon voyage. You're on to a whole new level. So, yes, so you're always going to be in this process of defining yourself, or I should say redefining yourself, but you need to know something. One, you need to respect and appreciate the distance of accomplishment that you have been able to achieve. You've covered a lot of ground.
Yes.
So you need to pat yourself on the back for that. Number two,
good point.
You need to be aware of the fact that part of what you have gone through has been to prepare you for being a speaker, an educator, so that you can communicate effectively with others. I think if most of us really had a conscious, mindful awareness that most of the garbage we go through is so that we wake up and we can pass our wisdom along, we'd say, good grief, who signed me up for this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
But we really have signed ourselves up for it. So you have awakened, and you are consciously alert, and that makes a difference. You're just not floating along ho-hum like you were 10 years ago.
No.
So you are saying, wait a minute, I am awake here, and I need to really pay attention. Now, you're going to have some conflicts in your working environment because of that. And one of the reasons the conflicts will be occurring is that you are going to see clearly some other people's objectives, some habit patterns, things that you know that are not really good stuff. Keep in mind, you cannot change them, but you can stay alert and aware, and you can be a leader in effect by your actions. So this is something that you are becoming cognizant of, that you don't have to take on other people's stuff. And it's not your duty to try to educate them so that they know better, unless they ask you to. But you will be one that will walk your walk. You're not just going to flap your lips and put out a whole bunch of words. You're walking the walk. And so there are going to be those few people, not many, but a few, that will be aware, and they're going to say, I want to know how you do that. Then you'll be able to share. But that's just the way life is. It's not good. It's not bad. You really have a good life. You do not have a bad life at all. However, you are anxious to break your own glass ceiling and you don't know exactly how to do it.
Yes. I feel like I know how to do it. I feel like I'm just being asked to be patient, which is the hard part for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe there's a couple of steps of information that you don't have. And that's not good or bad.
Okay.
This is not a criticism of you by any shade of color.
No.
Be aware that there's just a couple of pieces of information that you're missing. And they're going to come your way this year. Yes, being patient is very important, but also being alert is equally important, and that's what you're doing. What question did you have for me today?
Oh, wow. That was really dead on. But actually, my question was about moving. I need to move next week.
Mm-hmm.
Just sold a house. So now the next question is, where do I go? And I'm a little
up
in the air about it.
I would say don't even try to lock yourself into another house or anything like that. Just say, okay, where do I want to put myself temporarily? Rent a place. Put your stuff in storage if you want. Don't encumber yourself with any more anxiousness than necessary. All you need is an address right now so you can get your clarity. And pick a place that's going to be comfortable.
I also need money, though, and that's my big thing is that I only have so much to get me through. I don't have enough for a deposit, so my mind is just kind of confused as to what my next move should be.
Well, if you are open and you're willing and saying, I need to put your order into the universe and then start scouring the papers and just pick up the phone and call. Say, I need a place.
Okay.
This is what I have. I don't have a deposit. I could make payments towards that deposit are you open to this? Ask the questions. Don't assume.
Okay.
And you will find a place. It's not a big place, but it's a place that's very comfortable for you. You may even have someone that will say, do you want to share an apartment or a house? So put it out there. Let everyone you know that you are looking.
I'm going to have to.
Yes. There's no embarrassment here. This is what you're doing. You'll find it there.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're very welcome, Leslie. Thank you for calling in. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. You can chat to 888-815-9756. We're going to be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. I wanted to let you know about who is coming up on the show this week. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Gabriel Constant. This man has written a story about Buddha's wife. Now, what is so fascinating about this book is that he has researched history, and this is about how women were affected in that time frame. And I know we're dealing with thousands of years ago, but I'll tell you what, some things don't change. It's really amazing. Then we are going to be talking with Stephen Killen, and we've got music on Thursday. Oh, it is just going to be wonderful music and fascinating stories about a musical CD called Sapphire. It's just incredible. And then we're going to talk about Tasting the Universe with Maureen Seaberg. She's going to be my guest on Friday. So we have a dynamic lineup this week. And wow, what a lineup we've got for the month of April. So I invite you to stay alert and aware because the listing of information will be coming up before the first or by the first about the guests that will be coming up next month. And all you have to do is go to bbsradio.com, Station 1, The Donna Cebo Show, and go into the button that says Show Information, and it'll give you all the readout of everything that I've put in regarding that. Now, I said I had a recipe for you, but what I wanted to do was share something cute. I just love kids. They often use words that, as adults, we just go, where in the world did you get that? Well, kids have a way of putting things together that most of us would not even give 5 seconds of consideration to. But C. Ritchie said that her nephew didn't like vegetables at all. Something new with kids? Nah, lots of kids don't like vegetables. Well, his mother told him that Brussels sprouts were fairy cabbages. And this really worked well because his imagination took over that these were special little things grown by fairies. But it didn't work very well after he started kindergarten. One day he came home from school and he announced to his mother, I am not eating them anymore. My friend told me they're not fairy cabbages, they're Brussels sprouts. I know, out of the mouth of babes, but what can I tell you? Okay. I wanted to share a recipe for you. In our home, eggs are a very, very important part of our diet. I absolutely love the fix quiche, and my husband enjoys them a great deal. I know with a lot of guys, they go, yeah, quiche, you got to be kidding. But this is a very good way. A quiche is a wonderful way to use leftovers. And I came up with I came across a frittata, which is a quiche, Italian style, and it's using vegetables. And I think this is such a wonderful item to fix for a dinner if you want to have something really easy, that's easy to prepare. It's deliciously flavorful, and it is extremely healthy. So this is made with fontina, chard, and green olives. Now, remember, these ingredients can be adapted. Don't be afraid to use your imagination when you're cooking. Sometimes we don't always have what a recipe calls for, but that doesn't mean you can't put something else in it. But let me give you the recipe as it is because it is such an easy, easy one. Now, Swiss chard, you're going to need about 1.5 pounds. Now, you do want to be sure that you remove the tough stems, so you're going to want to wash them and just set them to the side. You're going to need six eggs, 2 tablespoons of half and half, 1/3 cup of shredded fontina cheese. I'd use more. That's me. I like cheese. Then you're going to need 1/4 cup of pitted green olives. You want to chop them up. 3/4 teaspoon of sea salt or kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter, and then you need 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, 2 tablespoons of finely chopped onion, or if you have got real good eyes that can handle it, just grate your onion. That gives it a whole different consistency. 1 clove of garlic, and you want to mince that finely, and 1/4 cup of chopped fresh parsley, and 1 teaspoon of chopped fresh thyme. Now, this is how easy this is. You want to have a big pot of water, and you want to get that water boiling over high heat. Throw in the chard, and you want to reduce the heat to medium. You cook it until it's tender. Now, Swiss chard can be a little bit tough. So just let it boil away for about 12 minutes. Put it through a strainer. Rinse it under cold water and put it in a towel and squeeze it dry, and then you chop. And then you squeeze it dry again. They're wanting you to get all the moisture out because you're putting this in a frittata. And when you put it in a frittata, you don't want your vegetables to have a lot of extra water in them because what you're going to end up with is a very wet frittata. So that's why it's encouraged for you to squeeze the Swiss chard. Now, your next 6 ingredients, your eggs, your half and half, your shredded cheese, your pitted green olives, your salt, and your pepper. Mix all those together and then mix in your chard. That's right. And then in a large nonstick skillet, you put your butter with your olive oil over medium-high heat. You add your onion, cook it for about 3 minutes, put in your garlic, cook that for an additional 1 minute, and this will have a fabulous fragrance to it. Pour your egg mixture over this, reduce your heat to low, and your eggs will begin to set. Now, I recommend using a spatula. You lift your edges to allow the uncooked egg portion to flow underneath that which has cooked. And you cook it until it's just firm around the edges and nearly set on top. And that's going to take you about 4 or 5 minutes, really fast. So what you want to do is invert a large flat plate over your skillet. Holding the pan and plate together, you flip, you lift off the skillet, return it to the heat, sprinkle half of your parsley and thyme over the bottom, slide the frittata, the brown side, up into your skillet, and cook it until browned on the bottom, which is going to take another 1 to 2 minutes, and then you can put it back out on a plate again and sprinkle with remaining herbs. Let me give you a Donna tip. If you don't want to go through that, once you've finished the basic part of cooking this, I would suggest adding a little bit of extra cheese, putting it underneath your broiler, leaving it in the pan, and then it will cook from the top down. I've done that many times. It just works beautifully. So either way works great. Calories are reasonable. The flavor is delicious. You can try different cheeses. It's awesome. This is Donna Sebo. I know we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. There are multiple universes out there, and you're part of it. And there are multiple parts to you. Enjoy the adventure and the journey of discovering who you are and how you can be even more of what you are already. It's a marvelous adventure. It's called life. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.